This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Stark. I'm joined here with Matt Pagan. Matt, it's great talking to you.
Yeah, good talking to you as always.
And we're going to be discussing themes dealing with the current culture war and how they relate to other issues, including economic issues and the wealth gap. I mean, the context of what we're discussing is an Unz article I wrote, and you also helped with that.
Yeah, that's right. The Unz article titled The Real Wealth Gap, published a couple weeks ago.
I mean, we discussed this on our previous show on the civil unrest, the kind of ongoing tribalism and encapsulated by the current BLM versus MAGA.
Yeah, and I think the subtitle of that article was What? How the BLM versus MAGA framing of everything basically ruins discussion on every issue worth talking about, because both sides correspond to a real regression in terms of pragmatic solutions.
In a material-based ideology, kind of some background on that, because I do know like some third position types will actually say like capitalism and communism are both flawed because they're purely materialistic. And then the kind of, like, dissident left, like, the dirtbag, if you want to call it dirtbag left or anti-woke left, they'll actually say that we need to return to a more materialistic-based left. So I don't think, like, a materialistic outlook doesn't explain everything, but I'll just say that the current dichotomy is focused primarily on symbolism and a hyper-moralistic framework. I mean, that's what's going on, but the thing is, the connection made in the article, like all these issues relating to like racial grievances are at the forefront in the media, and one of the big issues is that racial prejudice is the key driver of inequality in this nation.
Yeah, that's the framing of what, and this might be a bit reductive, but what we can sort of crudely summarize as the BLM position, or the position, the explanation that's provided by that side of the aisle is very much that this sort of racial injustice is the big driver of inequality in society, or at the very least the most important one to address.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not the most unifying message, but if we look at data, so this was brought up on on a previous show with the one of Ryan England. If we look at data on the racial wealth gap, it's not so much that it's non-existent. It does exist to some degree, but it only increases dramatically with age. It's less of an issue with millennials of
Well, what does the data show? I don't have the graph right in front of me, but basically it shows that there's a very substantial wealth gap between basically people from the baby boomer generation, between blacks and whites, so a racial wealth gap for baby boomers, but that obviously a lot of millennial whites start off somewhat financially better than a lot of millennial blacks, but whether or not that wealth gap will rise to the chasm that it is between baby boomers of the two races it seems unlikely, given how hard it's been shown for millennials, really of all races, to build any wealth. There's a lot of articles, many of which that you linked in the Unz article and that you pointed me to in the past. What's that guy's name? Joel Kotkin?
Yeah, Joel Kotkin.
You know, it's a known, it's somewhat of a known thing. You even see Bernie Sanders talking about it a little bit, the phenomenon of the screwed generation, and how hard it is for millennials to build wealth, how grim their prospects are of having anything like the quality of life of their parents, or certainly not even their grandparents.
Yeah, I mean, that issue, the intergenerational wealth gap, it was an issue with Bernie Sanders' campaign, and it was also brought up with Occupy Wall Street.
Well, the
and
I'm
kind of
thing...
thinking, I mean, kind of thinking back how, like, kind of like Fox News conservatives at the time they were very kind of dismissive of that. But the thing is, like, with
Occupy Wall Street,
yeah, or the whole kind of just kind of like ridiculing them for being like a screw generation. Because
so certainly within Occupy Wall Street, but that narrative has kind of substantially diminished over the past, shall we say, 10 years. You don't really see that narrative much anywhere at all. I mean, from my perspective, I remember Occupy Wall Street, and that was definitely a big part of Occupy Wall Street was generational, had to do with, college debt was a big issue talked about there. And certainly, Robert, the first Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016 did a really good job of carrying that torch. My argument would be that Bernie did a substantially less good job of carrying that torch of the generational wealth gap, or even just in focusing on purely economic issues at all in 2020. Maybe we'll get to that later. But the
I mean, the focus right now is racial inequality, and there's a link in the article to one of Zach Skolberg's graph, but like it does show you like mentions of these woke buzzwords in New York Times. Yeah, they took off,
they
like, right?
Took off to the moon, basically, after... I wish I had the graphs in front of me. Around 2011, basically, around 2011, 2012, basically right around the same time or right after Occupy Wall Street, which is indeed interesting. I mean, people remember, you know, sort of racial topics getting a lot more fraught because of Trump. Probably the sort of pop history will hold that, you know, Trump will remember that it was actually before Trump that the mainstream left wing and mainstream media and, you know, college campuses in general in 2013, 2014, 2015 really started taking a nosedive to the left on these racial issues, and that Trump was, in my opinion, way more of a response to that. I'm not defending everything that Trump has said. Obviously, he probably did say some inflammatory things if you go far enough back, but definitely the left side of the aisle, as Zach Goldberg's graphs have often shown in the past, moved further to the left before the right side of the aisle.
As you said, it was the first wave was after Occupy Wall Street, and then further after Trump, so... Yeah, this whole theme of, like, woke capital is interesting is because I think the economic elites, like, feared a big, like, they feared a sort of class-based insurrection from a kind of populist left, from Bernie supporters who were angry, and from all the people who are unemployed, like, that would be directed against the top 1%. So it is interesting how the media elites who are representing, like, elite economic interest are then saying the issue is that all of white American society is racist or systematic racism, as opposed to the economic angle. But the question is, like, how much of this is deliberate? Because I remember, I mean, so the show we did with Logo Daedalus, his view is he just thinks it's purely a advertising marketing strategy rather than a deliberate political agenda.
Yeah, I'll remain agnostic on that to an extent. I mean, I have no proof that that there's any kind of a psyop going on, or that any particular guidelines or funding were given to certain publications that Zach Goldberg showed to focus more on race issues after Occupy Wall Street. I don't have the evidence, so I'll remain agnostic. Definitely what Logo, I guess that's Logo's opinion about it being more of a marketing thing. I mean, that's valid too. Obviously, in the age of social media and everyone being on social media, obviously there did the kind of woke market, the market for woke ideas and signaling that you adhere to those, that obviously may have arisen simply because of the technology and not simply because of the technology and the cultural social shifts and not necessarily intentionally. But at the very least, it's worth noting, and one should at least be agnostic as to maybe there was, you know, a hand in that. Or at the very least, that maybe even if it started somewhat more organically, that people and corporations were quick to see the advantage.
And obviously both sides symbolize a focus on symbols. And obviously, I mean, symbols are very important. Yeah, I mean, focusing on what the statues symbolized to society, because the statues, it's no longer about slavery or the Confederacy. It does seem that they want to erase, like, all white culture prior to the 60s Civil Rights Act.
Yeah, and yeah. How long until it's after that as well? I mean, it's, I don't, you know, assume too much forethought behind the kind of
iconoclasm.
Iconoclasm we're seeing. I don't necessarily assume that much forethought. I think it's just a crass attack on symbols. And as you said, I think it goes well beyond the bounds of, anti-slavery or something, and more towards, you know, anything before the Civil Rights Act is bad and should be erased. And the general theme you're talking about is the importance of symbols, whether they're important or not.
What's interesting is they're older symbols of the past rather than symbols of the current power structure.
Yeah, no, that is interesting. They are kind of these symbols of the past. I mean, earlier you were talking about the difference between sort of material concerns versus symbolic concerns, and how there's a you don't want to reduce everything to
Yeah, I'll actually say this as I think there's a Like, I think, like, these people, the anti-woke left, like Amy Therese, I think someone like her is excellent. They have legit a lot of great criticisms against the woke left as a religion rather than materialistic. I think there are also limitations to, like, classical Marxists who are entirely materialistic and class reductionist. I think that ideology, I mean, that does have limitations as well.
Yeah, I'm kind of, I kind of end up in a, of two minds about this, or in a... A sort of an in-between mentality, because I recognize the ideal of focusing on material needs and material conditions and the problem with those and the pragmatic solutions to those. That has a lot of value, and especially for, you know, more intelligent people, it's easy to recognize that value and focus on that, and it all looks kind of good on paper. But the other, the kind of tragic, even we might even say, understanding that that's worth having is that at the end of the day, as kind of Pat Buchanan and that crowd has said, these issues like religion and race and just, shall we say, generally cultural tribalism, that stuff obviously is important. I mean, you can kind of, and it's always proved to have that importance. And we're seeing that importance play out in a big way. Well, we have obviously for the past 5 years with Trump, but especially this year, 2020, with this new sort of MAGA versus BLM, I hate to use the term, but culture war, this new chapter in the culture war, it seems like this kind of tribalism is the only thing, and that, you know, that adheres to our understanding that that these issues matter, but that doesn't negate the fact that it also is depressing, given that both tribes sort of have, in our estimation, a very limited account of the real problems in the current political climate.
Another view of that kind of dissident left view, and Andrew Yang has made similar points in the past, not so much anymore, is that, like, racism is a product of a scarcity mindset. So yeah. that view is closer, it's much more accurate than then the woke view on racism and white privilege and all that stuff. But the thing is,
yeah.
I do think it's naive to say like that the idea of a kind of colorblind, like class focused Marxist who would say let's redistribute the wealth and everyone will get along just fine. I mean, yeah, I think there's also definitely limitations to that as well.
Yeah, I mean, what we have to do is end up somewhere very nuanced and in the middle. I definitely don't think that it's a matter of, oh, we just need to tend to these material conditions and all these other problems will disappear. Absolutely not. I do, however, think that more meaningful conversations can be had and the worst elements of these things can be assuaged by taking care of the most worst material needs and issues. If we take care of those things, there's still going to be racial issues. There's still going to be cultural issues and clashing, but they're going to be a lot easier to deal with. I mean, America has always had racial issues and cultural issues and issues of clashing. It's always been there's always been that kind of melting pot issue. But there's definitely been times when those problems haven't led to anything like what we're seeing now. And
obviously, the economic factor is massive. That's leading to a lot of the tension. I know there is this kind of stereotype of the Antifa on a trust fund, but if you follow the news and like find out about most of the Antifa, let's say like the white Antifa who get arrested for looting and rioting. Like, you hear stories, like, a lot of cases, they're still going to community college well into their 20s, and they haven't had, like, stable employment. And then there's this, like, current economic crash. So, that obviously is huge, and that's not even being addressed enough. But back to the whole issue with iconoclasm and erasing history. I mean, a lot of it just seems like people causing chaos, but, like, looking at cancel culture, like, what is the sort of, like, end game of erasing history? And so if, like, the kind of, like, boomer conservative response would be that they're just a bunch of communists, it's a communist insurrection. But the question is, like, if there's less reminders of one's past, if someone does not have a connection to their past, it basically kind of lubes the way for a path forward for kind of a society of like neo-feudalism where everything's owned by a tech oligarchs and everyone lives in pods.
I mean, what you're saying is, there's the rationale behind Antifa and the more radical left elements of BLM. That is obviously their raison d'etre is the promotion of justice and equality. But looking at it from a more pragmatic perspective, as someone of a more right-wing or conservative mindset, what you're doing by erasing history, erasing institutions that don't immediately agree with your politically radical agenda, is basically paving the. It's stripping down kind of the old symbols of power and the old institutions, but. What that does kind of pragmatically, regardless of what the intention might be, is that it paves the way for new tyranny, new vectors of power, which are far more, I mean, the power held by, say, Amazon or any of these big corporations is so much more demonstrable than the power represented by a Confederate statue or a George Washington statue or a Theodore Roosevelt statue or whatever the latest statue to come down might be. These are kind of symbols of an older sort of power, and I guess maybe what you're trying to say is that the real power held in society, which is not necessarily equitable, has a very different face.
One example of that is Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, is openly like promoting this iconoclasm, and Amazon is basically like the one institution that is ushering us into this new era of neo-feudalism.
Yeah, and I mean, is it, regardless of how committed Amazon is to, to racial justice and to diversity, and perhaps even one day Amazon will get by, I mean, I actually almost see it hard to imagine they won't one day get behind some version of UBI, no matter how much they try to fundamentally to promote some version of equality and justice, whether or not that kind of corporate palliative distributionism it really corresponds to what someone, say, Antifa wants, I think is highly questionable. And obviously, from our perspective or from most conservative perspectives, that's going to be not a future anyone wants.
Yeah, I mean, there's all these, like, examples of corporations like Woke Capital and Darren Beatty on Twitter giving examples of these massive, like, kind of corporate handouts, like donating to Black Lives Matter and different woke causes, or more like affirmative action programs within the corporation. Like the kind of cliche of neoliberalism is that we need more women and people of color on corporate boards. I mean, that kind of like policy, like woke capitalism, as opposed to a class-based left. And then there's obviously that D'Angelo, the author of White Fragility. Her background is she's a corporate consultant. So there's all that, and that's pretty obvious. What's interesting is like what Jack from the Perfume Nationalist said about neoliberalism erasing history and concealing power is you could actually make different parallels. You could talk about like what the Statue of Columbus symbolizes. The Statue of Columbus, there was a giant one they took down in Coit Tower in San Francisco, like what that symbolizes, like what type of power it symbolizes. And then, you could also actually make parallels to some of these kind of this sounds really convoluted, but you could almost make a comparison to these mall renovations, like where they take an 80s postmodernist mall and they turn it into these kind of bland tech campuses, like kind of looking at the aesthetic of neoliberalism and just any Silicon Valley tech campus that was built in the last like 15 years does really like capture that aesthetic.
To be clear, the aesthetic you're talking about is what at least Jack from the Perfect Nationalist has called the aesthetic of neoliberalism, which he defined as an aesthetic characterized by the concealing of wealth, basically paying a lot for something bland, for something that does not flaunt the wealth behind it.
I mean, trends in architecture, but I think also like foodie trends. So like the cupcake trend is a perfect example of that phenomenon. Mac and cheese with foie gras, like.
Oh, so it's basically the kind of going back to the sort of bobo, bohemian bourgeois, hipster aesthetic to some extent. I think there's some aspects of that aesthetic that I've identified with it to a small amount in my life. It's maybe not all bad, but there is that kind of level of concealing wealth and concealing power and concealing where that really lies.
And obviously, like, the dissident rights, like, interest in, like, the fast wave aesthetic, these large, like, grandiose Roman statues and then giant, like, neon skyscrapers, like, symbols that project, that do project power.
Yeah, I mean, I've been trying to write an article about this, and I've been kind of dipping in and out of it because it's a fairly large topic. I mean, I think one could write a book about it. But basically that, with the kind of vaporwave aesthetics you're talking about, for example, or even if we're talking about 80s malls or neon, things that we've been kind of autistic about on this podcast, these things kind of represent, they're like the crown jewels of these more hierarchical societies. And like these kind of aesthetics, whether it's a Greek sculpture or you could even, you know, talk about the mall. These aesthetic reflexes of an elite, they're aesthetic reflexes of the elites of their time, but they also reflect a certain noblesse oblige aesthetic product that can be enjoyed by all levels of society, whereas the kind of more aesthetic products of the neoliberal elite, you know, tech campuses was the idea you gave. Some of the more aesthetic reflexes of the current neoliberal elite are even harder to name because they're not accessible. They're the product of privatization. These things lack that noblesse oblige. And I'm reading Anna Kachan recently supplied a good quote from Christopher Lash's last book. I think it's called Something About the Elite, Christopher Lash's last book, about how and Lash wrote this. He's the author of The Culture of Narcissism. He wrote this book in 1994, shortly before his death, and he was talking about how the rising elite he saw at that time clearly had they were increasingly isolated from all other classes of society, and purposely so. That he describes in that book, I think Revolt of the Elites, is it called? Hold on. Increasingly, basically the elite, the meritocratic elite in America and in the West generally, were insulating themselves from the lower classes of society, whom they saw as, you know, irrevocably sexist, misogynistic, xenophobic, etc. And it's interesting, that was 1994, and obviously the effects of that were...
I think that's probably around the time David Brooks wrote Bobos in Paradise. So in the article I wrote on Unz, I do talk about the whole housing issue with NIMBYism. I mean, the YIMBY movement, they focus more on the supply of housing rather than the cultural implications. Or they talk about the cultural implications from a woke... A lot of them are very woke. But the symbolism of what architecture symbolizes. So, yeah, these private tech campuses. I linked to the Steve Saylor article about Malibu. Like a mega mansion in Malibu, that projects power, but more in a very kind of hyper-individualistic sense. Say, like, a wealthy NIMBY in Santa Monica, they might oppose, like, a high-rise is going up. And high-rises are symbols of, yeah, they can be symbols of capitalism, but they also symbolize power in a more collective sense, even if they're like a... I mean, I'd even say, like, even financial institutions, like in New York City, like, even those buildings, despite their economic policies, they do symbolize... Like, the World Trade Center down did symbolize, like, the power of the United States. Like, they do symbolize collective power, as opposed to symbolizing private individual power.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, privatization is the key word here. What do we mean when we talk about neoliberalism? As far as we define it as something that we oppose, I would say neoliberalism has two key characteristics, and those are one, globalism, which obviously, you know, we don't even need to go into being anti-globalist. That's kind of a given, probably for anyone listening to this podcast. But the other concept to focus on is privatization, and this ties into the NIMBYism that you talk about, being opposed to these manifestations of wealth that are completely individualistic and privatized. There's no sense of that noblesse oblige that the argument would be that would arise in a more cohesive society. There's a natural degree. It strikes close to home for us, because how much of what we've done over the years in terms of podcasts, but also videos and trips we've done and photo journals, how much of it is kind of capturing these spaces that we love.
Kind of looking like at the kind of early the robber barons of the early 20th centuries, like the Vanderbilts, they helped build Grand Central Station, and the Rockefellers, they built the Rockefeller Center, and then, I mean, obviously there were problems with capitalism back then, but they did, like, also in, like, national parks, and, yeah, I mean, with, they took down, like, the statue of Teddy Roosevelt, in New York City at the, like, the Natural History Museum by Central Park, and, what he symbolized, like, he was someone who, he created the national park system, trust busting, breaking up monopolies. Yeah, I mean, Teddy Roosevelt, someone who invested in American civilization, that basically built up America when it was at its peak, rather than, like, the kind of neoliberalism, which you could say is just kind of, like, managing the decline. One example I'll give is, like, going back to these different hotel lobbies that I visited on trips, one example is, like, the hotel in Union Square in San Francisco, like, the first time I took the external glass elevator up overlooking Union Square, and then the second time I went back after that, it was closed off to the public. It was only for hotel patrons. So the trend of, like, more kind of places being closed off, and I think we'll see that more and more with, like, the crime wave. Yeah, with the COVID and crime and civil unrest. One thing is interesting is, I don't know if you watched that video clip, but on Fox News, it was Laura Logan and Laura Ingraham. They were actually comparing statue removal iconoclasm. They were comparing it to the push to upzone suburbia. They were like describing, comparing it to communism, basically.
Yeah.
But it's kind of interesting because I obviously have a different perspective as they do. Both the statue and the single family home, they are important as symbols.
Yeah, you write that in the article how the single family home is predominantly it's offended by conservatives for perhaps for good reason, because this represented the American dream for several generations, the single family home in the suburbs with a big family, etc. But you go into how the degree to which that might only be a symbol in this day and age, more so than it reflects a real reality.
A lot of that is based on my own experiences and observations. I did reference in the article the debate between over the housing. So there was that bill SB 50 in California that would just upzone areas around public transit, and that was actually that was voted down by the state legislature. And then a much more ambitious bill, a series of bills in Virginia. Mm-hmm. That would have abolished exclusive zoning to single-family for single-family homes. So, yeah, I mean, the right-wing media, like, basically all the major figures in Fox News, like Tucker, both Tucker and Ingraham, were very outraged about that. Yeah, they view it as, like, left-wing social engineering. And then the thing is, like, in the case of Virginia, there were politicians on the left making explicit, like, woke causes. There is like a big kind of woke urbanism scene. Yeah, they talk about how like exclusive single family home zoning is racist. I mean, there's a link to this. Like, they will explicitly advocate using zoning as a way to diversify the suburbs, mm-hmm. and also redistribute wealth. So yeah, very, very divisive rhetoric. Conservatives will often point to examples of Democrats. And then this is not hypothetical. This has actually happened. Like, the push to construct Section 8 housing in suburban areas. Yeah. I mean, you're probably familiar with a place in near LA called Palmdale. That's basically how that area was transformed. So that area was never a well-off area. That area was always kind of a cheaper area. So yeah, and just some of the kind of really horrific rhetoric that came out during the riots. About explicit criminal threats against suburban neighborhoods on Twitter.
Yeah, so that came out during the riots, but your point would be that that kind of rhetoric, you see a version of it behind the argument, the kind of woke arguments in favor of upzoning as well, where basically it's a hatred of the idea of white neighborhoods and an idea of kind of the destruction of these areas, or the repurposing of them, or basically just the moving in of many people as a socially woke project, or as a social as an increaser of social justice.
Yeah, a lot of urbanist YIMBYs explicitly make it on those cases. So like one example is they'll do like a geographic profile, because I follow a lot of YIMBYs and urbanists on Twitter, of a major urban suburban area. So they'll show an area that's denser and more diverse, then they'll point to a suburban area and they'll say this area is like 80% white, maybe we need to upzone it to increase diversity. So they explicitly make those kind of arguments, basically. Mm-hmm. What the single family home symbolizes, what it was in the past, and then also how it's kind of idealized in film, like movies that take place in the 50s or 60s, 70s, 80s, or even more recently in the suburbs, and that idealized lifestyle. But I think this is a fundamental key. You sort of have to go to places like Utah to kind of experience that more kind of like 1950s American way of life. Like, what does this single family home area, like, what does it represent in, say, the San Fernando Valley, or in the Silicon Valley? I mean, you actually, I don't want to get too personal for you, you lived in an area with roommates that was a single-family home area in the San Fernando Valley, and it didn't really, like, would you say it really captured that kind of idealized past?
No, yeah, it doesn't at all. I mean, there was, in terms of, like, families, you get a lot less of them here. There was kind of white flight through the 80s and 90s. And basically, yeah, in the Valley, in the San Fernando Valley, but in California in general, as you pointed out, it's a kind of, is very much a thing of the past.
You have older white people who are, who've lived in that area a really long time. If you, you have lots of situations with roommates sharing a home. You also, you do have like new immigrants coming in, but it's not like the traditional like American nuclear family area that's, that conservatives would idealize.
Yeah, no, no.
And another, I mean, another trend I've noticed, a lot of the wealthier parts of LA and just like suburban Southern California in general, like the wealthier areas I've noticed have seen like a rapidly aging population.
Yeah, and that's another dynamic, and that's another offshoot of what we're talking about. You know, when you don't invest in the next generation economically or culturally, what you're going to get is an aging population.
The, I mean, these are the people who are like the absolutely most privileged. So, I mean, there's narrative, there's kind of a narrative of like elite suppressing people from the classes below them, but then like they're declining in some ways too. Like, but that's also symbolic of their decline. Like, so that's, I mean, that's one way to look at it.
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying. That even though they're trying to withhold some kind of power, it's not even like they're doing that in an effective way. It's just you have this aging population and a not burgeoning younger population, and both are kind of mutually in decline. The question then becomes, in as far as there's a NIMBY movement within California, well, what exactly are they preserving? Who are the California NIMBYs? Certainly, it doesn't really, the conservative interests that might apply to some degree elsewhere.
Like with the argument about racism, that liberal woke NIMBYs say that NIMBYs are racists who want to prevent demographic change. But the thing is, like, there are boomers who own single-family homes who do view it that way. But the thing is, that's not really an issue now because demographic change has continued regardless. And if you look at places like San Fernando Valley and the Silicon Valley, they're mostly single-family homes, but they've still been transformed demographically. And the thing is, like, it's just basic like supply and demand. So immigration levels and restricting housing through NIMBYism are just going to create an even greater scarcity for millennials looking to buy or rent. And it does seem like a lot of millennials are, especially white millennials, are just flat out saying they're going to leave leave California and go to Boise, Idaho, or to Austin.
Yeah, or Colorado. I mean, it's already happened. So as you point out in the article, like what basically that the NIMBY cause in California is really, it's really only hurting young people. There's no good conservative NIMBY case to be made within the context of California, and in time there won't be really anywhere in the country. It's really almost impossible to start a family or to just to be a middle class person in California. Either you're like a lower class renter living basically check to check, and in that case it feels to many of us irresponsible to start a family. You're either that or you're part of a wealthy class, but there's really...
Or the people who are a lot of, like, retirees left over from an era when there was a strong middle class, but just kind of, like, kind of these trends that are affecting the suburbs now, like the ethno-burbs and, or just kind of aging suburbs full of empty nesters. Because you mentioned Joel Kotkin. He does talk about millennials being screwed in California, but his solution is, I don't think he really has a solution. He's basically like a sprawl apologist. Like his solution is just building more single family homes as sprawl, like into the Inland Empire or out into the desert. And that, I mean, that's a really bad idea. He seems to have some weird fixation that you need a single family home to start a family. And he's actually opposed to the sort of like urbanizing or upzoning like areas like within LA or the Silicon Valley. The thing about it is like, I mean, what are the issues of quality of life? I mean, education, like local schools are a huge issue. Like the size, maybe like the size, if you're going to buy a condo, like you want adequate space. You want to be able to buy something. I mean, there are benefits to having a single family home if you have like a nice backyard. but just kind of the notion that that it's the only way to live. It's just some weird obsession in our culture.
It is a weird obsession in our culture. It's very kind of boomer, sort of goes along with this thing that, so many non-Americans, and in particular I've heard it from Europeans, kind of criticize Americans on, is wanting everything big and more spacious than it needs to be. The big car, the big house, and there, I think, is, this almost goes without saying, but I think there's a very healthy degree to which we can move on from that obsession with bigness and unnecessary space without fully going liberal or woke. I mean, you could be conservative and just simply think that that ideal was always kind of crass and wasteful and unnecessary, and advocate, without fully advocating living in pods and eating Soylent. Basically, that there's a line between advocating living in pods and eating Soylent. I mean, there should be a kind of a nuanced middle ground on this, and what you advocate isn't necessarily a return to the single family home ideal and building more and more, but you rather advocate what? New urbanism, right, Robert?
Yeah, I guess new urbanism kind of falls under that umbrella. Like, they kind of have this dichotomy that we're either you buy a single family home in the suburbs or all going to live in pods, which is, I mean, those are two kind two ridiculous kind of extremes. Like, who are the YIMBYs? Like, there is definitely a strong woke angle, and a lot of that is just because, like, most college-educated younger people do adopt woke ideology, are influenced by woke ideology, but that the key thing it is millennials and now increasingly Zoomers from middle-class backgrounds who have worked hard, played by the rules, and have found the American dream unattainable. Yeah. And then a lot of other things about, like, conservative NIMBY sympathy is that most of the forefront of that tends to be, like, wealthy older liberals in places like Southern California.
And definitely in California and Malibu and stuff, yeah. I mean, what you're talking about, it's yet another example, as we were talking about earlier with kind of the BLM versus MAGA ugly culture war that's going on now. It's another example of symbolic sort of warfare where it's two sort of crass cartoon versions of a position pitted against each other, and we're all asked to, throw our hat in the ring with one cartoonish side or the other, whereas what we really should be advocating are these nuanced positions that, they may be on one or the other side, but either way, they're not the full cartoonish version. Again, to reiterate, the cartoonish versions being, in this case, full anti-white wokeness, or full boomer, defend our Walmart's ism.
Or one other issue I mentioned, actually, Prop 13 is the whole property tax thing, which favors wealthier retirees and disfavors young families. What conservatism means, and I don't identify as a conservative, but what it does mean to be a conservative, because the core demographic for conservatism has always been, like, middle class families. Younger people who are single and living with roommates in small apartments, they're obviously going to support the left if there's no material incentives being provided by conservatives. Yeah, I mean, you can almost say it kind of, like, mean lifelong adolescence. And what Tucker Carlson said, this was earlier, in the very beginning of this year, I think.
Yeah, in January.
It was when Bernie was rising in the polls, and it was basically a warning to Trump and the Republicans. He said he predicted that the candidate who makes it easier for 30-year-olds to get married and have kids will win the election and deserve to win, that you have to provide material incentives. And obviously both left and right, Republicans and Democrats, have completely failed on this. And you see a lot, all the younger whites from like the working class to the upper middle class, those backgrounds, going over to Sanders. And a big part of that is that the current system has failed them.
The Tucker Carlson said that back in January. I believe the occasion was both Bernie rising the polls, but also this passing of the date, what is it, January 21st, where there was a recognition that in 1 year's time we may have a new president. And he said that, it was a warning to, obviously he is a Trump supporter and his to a degree, and his base, the people who watch him, are largely Trump supporters and Republicans, but it was kind of a warning to that crowd that if you don't make policies that demonstrably are going to make people's lives better, you're going to lose the election. And it's a good point. It's something that conservatives, the Republican Party, have really failed on over the past, say, 30 years. Basically, the more stake a person is able to have in society, whether through a stable job, marriage, children, sending those children to school, the more of those stakes people have, the more naturally conservative, small c conservative, not big C, you know, ideologically conservative, but small c, you know, promoting these things that are good for the rearing of families. I mean, that's as small c conservative as you need to be. The more incentive you have in society, the more conservative you're going to be. And it basically, the Republican Party has promoted economic policies that make that increasingly impossible for American middle class youth and young adults. And in so doing, they've pretty much dug their own grave, because, as you said, you know, devoid of being able to start a family, being able to have a good steady work, you basically, and you know, I think that you and I both have probably lived this ourselves to certain degrees. You're put in a position, regardless if you're liberal or not, you know, you're put in a position where you basically feel like you're a lifelong adolescent. And what do lifelong adolescents do? They naturally swing more towards not simply just liberal positions, but also kind of the even crass sort of reductionist.
Yeah, I would say that the alt-right is the alt-right was the product of the same phenomenons that you saw with those Bernie supporters.
I mean, yeah, that's always been the argument. It's a conglomeration of different factors, but the good element of that movement anyway was I think a real looking at an alternative kind of right wing or conservative outlook that took these, that kind of freed itself a bit from ideology and reductionism, and actually thought about how to make people's lives better. I mean, that's the healthy aspect of it. Not even getting to the racial stuff. Just the mere, you might find the racial stuff very regrettable, but the mere fact that the opinions are based on how to make people's lives better, how to promote an existence for a people in general, is actually a healthier alternative to really anything you get in on either side of the mainstream political spectrum, if that makes sense.
Back to the original theme of this whole kind of ongoing movement, we are going through all these different trends that are creating transition. The future of urbanism, remote work, like all these people leaving the major cities, like what kind of communities will they build? Will they be better, more cohesive, both culturally and as far as urbanism? Or will they make the same mistakes that were made in the past? And then there's the whole economic crisis. Yeah, the trends that we're going to be seeing, like we are seeing this kind of like urban exodus, remote work is accelerating that, and the virus, the pandemic, all the like issues relating to the riots and crime. Yeah, this kind of new wave of suburban white flight, and how it's different than past waves. Yeah, I mean, you have these places like Northern Virginia, like perfectly captures this this kind of a demographic, because it's political and a kind of geographic isolation from the urban decay. So like the first wave to the suburbs, like those people tended to be much more conservatism. So the whole kind of like being able to like have your cake and eat it too. These are the kind of places where, I mean, there are like kind of more like hybrids of the best, creating hybrids of like cities and suburbs. So you have your own kind of like safe community with single family homes, but then mixed in with like new urbanism and these kind of new manufactured like walkable downtowns and access to like all the kind of swipple amenities like ethnic food and like basically a lot of the stuff that you would get in the city. And a lot of these people, like you will see like hipsters from Williamsburg and Brooklyn moving to these suburbs. And one thing that is interesting about this, it will have an impact on our next election. I mean, it looks like Biden will win, and this is the demographic that he will win. And it basically, it is like the demographic that supports, like, basically, like what you would just, like, woke neoliberalism.
Look, Yeah, you're talking about, you're basically talking about white college-educated suburban voters who are,
yeah, exactly,
are a key swing voting demographic, and what you're describing is the kind of liberalization of the suburbs. That's too simplistic. The increasing degree to which the American suburbanite identifies kind of more with a neoliberal elite, as we might say, or globalization. There's a degree to it. The suburbs have traditionally been a, if not a, they've always had a, something of a swing element to them, but they've basically always been something of a red stronghold. Well, the suburbs have traditionally been something of a red stronghold, or at least a red-leaning stronghold. And in the era of Trump, a lot of white college-educated suburbanite voters are increasingly identifying more with the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and this trend has been it's been going on to some degree since like the neoliberal kind of Clinton era of the 90s. But I think I see it accelerating with this like new wave of white flight out of like major cities to the suburbs. I mean, if we assume urban decay is going to happen, it seems to be that way. Actually, my observation, I mean, you're in L.A., but mm-hmm. I don't think L.A. is anywhere near as bad as the situation in York's in.
Not anywhere near. There's also not a lot of white people to leave L.A. at this point, so it's not. The dynamics are a lot different than the are very different than the East Coast cities. But yeah, my impression is that in New York, that there could be a degree of urban decay. Certain, maybe even less so in New York than, well, for a great example, Minneapolis, some of these Midwestern and Southern cities, many of which have already experienced white flight, will probably experience more. But to your point, what's interesting, and this could go down maybe as like perhaps Trump's major blind spot going into his 2020 reelection campaign, is that yeah, the numbers seem to indicate he's really not going to do well with kind of the white suburbanite voter.
So yeah, that is the short-term trend in the next election cycle or two. Yeah, I mean, I don't think that kind of trend is sustainable long-term. And by that trend, I mean living in these kind of suburban communities and being sheltered from overall like social problems. Like, what's interesting is we were talking about like the Virginia housing bill, and I remember like some kind of right wing types were ironically supporting that bill because those types of places like Northern Virginia, they're basically the key demographic for neoliberalism. But at the same time, they don't necessarily want a lot of them were opposed to like this dramatic upzoning.
Yeah, I mean they're a good demographic for neoliberalism, but right now, what you're seeing is, obviously, as we've talked about, is the marrying of neoliberalism policy with a kind of more far-left, culturally Marxist mindset, and it's that may prove to be something of an unhappy marriage in the long run. In the short term, it seems to be working. In the short term, it seems to be giving a lot of kind of white college-educated suburbanites a pretty shocking number of them have really bought into a lot of the BLM stuff, and it for a lot of people, even very like bland, square normie types, it kind of feels like there's a degree to which they're really willing to buy into this package and at least pay lip service to it for now. Whether or not in the long run that will translate into policy that they will remain supportive of.
Yeah, I mean, all these different long-term trends, like what happens economically, if that particular kind of college-educated suburban group, if they manage to be the group that does thrive in this kind of new future we're entering to, or if that group, as we've discussed earlier, like a lot of the Zoomers and Millennials from that group, whether they'll experience economic hardships, and what and what impact, like what political direction will that put them in. But I guess, like, with the whole kind of, like, intergenerational angle of the older generation, I mean, has failed to pass on, like, wealth and power to the youth. I mean, you could also say kind of just in general, you do see, like, the role that younger whites have, like, going into the future, and the kind of how younger whites are for become joining up with this kind of POC coalition. But the question is, like, the older generation of whites failed to invest in them economically, and now you're seeing a lot of them joining up with this new woke POC coalition.
Yeah, I mean, they failed to invest in them on almost every level. I mean, it's economic. They failed to invest in them economically is a huge factor, but also culturally. I mean, that might not be completely any individual member of Gen X or the Boomer generation's fault, but it's an important thing to remember. There's been this failure to kind of pass down values, for lack of a better term, or any sense of shared history or any kind of healthy cultural or national pride. That's been pretty much since the 60s.
Look, what we were saying with NIMBY, the NIMBY thing is like NIMBYism. The problem with that is it's based more on thinking in terms of hyper-individualism rather than thinking about securing like an existence for your descendants.
Yeah, no, exactly. And there's just been this, that, you know, obviously, inevitably, you pass down a lot to your children. But when you're dealing with something like hyper-individualism encapsulated by an ideology like NIMBYism, it's kind of a hard sell. You're not really passing down anything substantive to your offspring.
Also, like, one motive is, like, there's all this kind of, like, social decay in society, so you want to use physical space within urbanism to create a physical buffer between yourself and those growing social problems. That is understandable to a degree, but the way it's been dealt with has not had a good impact.
Yeah, I mean, it's an overcorrection, it's a reduction. I mean, there's this sense of, you know, it's like with Reaganomics in general. It's this, you know, we're not communists, so we're going to be the furthest thing from communists. But it actually, you know, leads, I think, in the long run, ironically, to this burgeoning kind of cultural Marxism in the United States. So it's just another example of a kind of emotional over-correction in the other direction rather than really thinking through things in any kind of nuanced way. Back to those kind of, you know, symbolic one-upmanship or symbolic warfare that we were talking about earlier. It's that kind of stuff. There's very much cause for pessimism because right now we are as far from being a cohesive society as we've ever been. We're sort of locked into these vicious, again, I hate to use the term, but I just don't know how else to put it, culture wars issues that, as you say in your article, prevent us from really talking about the myriad. And it's with COVID this year of 2020, it's more pertinent than it's ever been. All these conversations we should be having about what the future could look like and how it could be better for people, better for the environment. All these worthwhile topics are completely choked out by these symbolic battles, you know, anti-white wokeness on the one side, and you know, obviously I do put most of the blame there. But even on the other side, people who revert back to a baser version of conservative republicanism, which basically just reduces to sort of petty defenses of symbols that that are kind of foregone already, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, symbols are important because symbols are aesthetic, and that's always been a big theme on the show. But I guess it's just overly reductionist, like there's all these different issues. There's class, there's morality, there's aesthetics, there's demographic issues, there's just all these different... Yeah, I mean, it's overtly reductionist to just make one single issue the center point. But I guess to kind of conclude this show... Yeah, just how polarized things are, and then how it spreads to issues that should be more practical. So, like, we touched on the housing issue. I mean, traditionally, that should be an issue that is should be a more practical issue, but that, like many other things, has got absorbed into the ongoing culture war.
Yeah, no, that's a very, productive example that you've often use, because the conversation about where people are supposed to live and where and if they're supposed to raise families should be, it is a bread and butter issue that we should be able to talk about beyond the political dichotomy, but we can't because it gets injected with, again, this symbolic battleground. I mean, it's an interesting topic, that the whole we just talked about.
Oh yeah, for sure. Matt Pagan, it's been an excellent show. Thanks for being on, and but it'll be interesting to follow these trends in the near future.
Yeah, no, I feel like we could revisit these themes on another show soon. I mean, this show is kind of all over the place in some ways, but I think we struck on some really important themes. So thank you for having me.